Viewers, listeners, welcome to another edition of Blighty Talks Bricks. My guests today have a long history in the property development world. Their late father, Alan Cherry, was the founder of Countryside Properties back in 1958, and both Richard and Graham worked in the business until 2017 and 2019, respectively. They are now both co-chair owners of Stone Bond, a family business that was started back in 1975. I've known both companies for many years and have worked with them on projects going back a lot longer than I want to remember. So I'm really looking forward to chatting to both Richard and Graham today. Chaps, hello, how are you?
Well, very well, and thank you for having us, and great to see a Gooner in a West Ham shirt, may I say.
Lovely, isn't it?
I was hoping that, obviously this goes out a little bit later, but I was hoping that when I wore this, there might be a bit more love involved, because I thought you might have been able to do us a favour in the weekend that's just gone past.
Yeah, well, the boys failed you, didn't they?
You didn't fail, it was down to us. But no, I was telling you chaps earlier, I've got a real soft spot for West Ham. I genuinely believe they're the best supported club in London. Especially when they were sort of bouncing around a bit. But I also remember being your guest back in the day when you had your boxer up at
Tottenham Park. Yeah.
So I didn't wear an Arsenal shirt there either because I wouldn't have got out alive. But but you boys still follow West Ham a little bit?
Yeah. We've both got seats there, so we go quite a bit. And our boys are West Ham fans, generally. So yeah.
In our area, when I was young, if you didn't support West Ham, you were taking around the back of the bike sheds and
Beating up
until you did. So, yeah. We're lifelong fans. Cut us in half a claret and blue.
Well, I was born literally 3 minutes from Shoreditch, where we're filming this from now, and it's right on the line. And most of the kids at my school, it was Arsenal West Ham. Mm. And as I say, I've got a fond affection for them. So. And I'm glad you picked up a trophy last season.
Yeah, it was wonderful, wasn't it? Well, it's full of character, isn't it, West Ham? That's the thing we love about it.
Yeah, it's got everything. And it's very kind of you to give us Declan Rice, by the way, as well. We'll forget the 100 million. It was worth every penny.
Yeah, no, he's a brilliant player.
Moving on, I know you've got your own podcast, so I'm not going to go back into the ages because I know that you're doing a great job with that. All About Housing, which I've watched you guys on, I think, four episodes, I think. It's a real good listen. So I want to talk about more things into where we are today, really. How's life going at Stone Bond?
Yeah, I think we're pleased with where we've got to. We'd like to be making more money, but obviously we're in a challenging climate. But we've really, although the business has been around for a long time, since 1975, it didn't really get going until about 2015-16, and now the business is all based on mixed tenure housing. So we do 70% of what we do, we as we call it, we pre-sell it to housing associations and investors, and then 30% is private. But we've grown it. We've got a great team. We've got six regional offices, and we've got now a platform, I think, for growth. But challenging, you know, we've had a challenging climate.
Very challenging.
Lots of challenges. Post-COVID inflation, a government that doesn't really like new housing,
non-existent,
tough planning system, high interest rates and so on. But amongst all that, we put together a great team. We've got a lot of new business, a good pipeline of business, and it's exciting. You know, for us, it's probably as exciting as when we started at Countryside, if not more, I think. You know, it's an opportunity to create something that's different. So, we enjoy it.
Yeah, I think since we started, I started in 1980, we've been through four really tough trading periods, and this is probably right up there with the worst.
Yeah, for me, I'm not that many, but for me, absolutely.
And I think that experience has helped us get through. I think beginning of last year, as interest rates started moving up, our quality management team, we're really looking to Richard and I for inspiration and that experience. And in a perverse way, we sort of rather enjoyed increasing the amount of time we're giving the company, probably full time now, in using our experience and guiding them through these difficult waters.
Because you've seen it before. Yeah, in a different way.
Everyone's different.
Every challenge is different. Every period of downturn is different. I think this is a lot's happened at the same time, isn't it, with the challenges of the economy, planning and so on. But I think on this occasion, because of this government negativity with government around housing, I think it's the first time that, for example, a government hasn't done something for first-time buyers during a, during a downturn, which I think is very disappointing. So I think that's what makes it different and possibly a bit tougher than we've had in the past. But, you know, you've got to look, to the opportunities, haven't you, during these times? And every 10 years or so it happens. And I think the thing is to, you know, look positively and see what you can do. I mean, we've recruited great people, put together some good sites for the future. So there's been that opportunity. So not all bad, certainly.
I think last year was particularly difficult, 23. This year we saw some green shoots appear at the beginning of the year as mortgage rates sort of fell. And then about 5 or 6 weeks ago, they started to rise again, and you could feel the wind go out of the sails.
Yep.
And literally last week, interest rates have come down, mortgage rates have come down a little bit. And this weekend, we've had a good level of inquiries come through. So you really are living slightly on tenterhooks, wondering what you're in store for week in, week out.
A guy from Heron Financial on a few weeks ago on the podcast, and he said that the demand is there. It's just the mortgage products are not there to help people, as you say.
Yeah, something
for first-time buyers.
Yeah. I mean, I think, as you well know, we need to build as a nation 300,000 houses per annum for each year for the next 20 years, so 6 million new homes. And everybody who ever does the research comes out with the same figures. So last year, I think the industry built 120,000, 150,000 houses. This year, same again. So we're undersupplying a market that's short of products. So the demand, underlying demand is huge.
No, for sure.
With interest rates being so high, affordability being stretched, people are waiting. I think there's a lot of treading water going on, waiting for mortgage rates to come down, waiting for their jobs to feel more secure in their jobs, waiting for the election and get the uncertainty of
the
government
the next key
and
thing,
policy.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though the polls say one thing, and that must mean the pollsters are talking to people and they're craving for a change in government, they still hold back because they want to know what the real policies are. And that level of that uncertainty that we've found over years just will mean more people hanging on and waiting. So
An awful lot of what we do is we package up housing for housing associations, particularly and investors. And, you know, to an extent, that demand's carried on from those guys, and that's really helped us as a business. But, of course, they have had their own distractions on fire remedial works and mould and so on and all of that stuff. But that is there, and that's provided a very solid income for our business. So, you know, thank goodness that that's where we've been.
So sticking on the fact, and the word government gets mentioned on the podcast, I have my magic wand. Blighty Talks Bricks magic wand. I normally only got one person on the podcast with me, so I'm not going to give you three wishes each.
One each.
If I was to say, okay, you got two wishes each that we're going to put into play tomorrow to help Great Britain PLC deal with A, the recession, and also, more importantly for this podcast, the housing crisis that we currently have, what things would you guys bring into play?
I personally, my two wishes would be firstly, some form of assistance with the first-time buyers, whether it be stamp duty holiday or reintroduction of the Help to Buy scheme, that inevitably stimulates help for first-time buyers. The housing market is it continually needs to keep moving, and that will help as it has done many times in the past. And I think for the government, they need to understand how important housing and the housing new housing business is to the wider economy in terms of the amount of contribution to tax it generates, the amount of jobs it generates, not just in the house building business itself, but every time somebody buys a house, they're going to go and buy new curtains, carpets, kettles and all sorts. So it's a widespread influence. So that would be my first wish. And the second is that the government has what I describe as a Billy Big Boy conversation about planning and how we can help provide these much needed homes, not just this year or next year, for the next 20 years, because the fortunes of young people are really, really affected by house prices and other things that the government have done, which means that private rent is going through the roof. And it's a very difficult outlook for young people in particular. And I think we need, as a nation, to have a really mature Billy Big Boy conversation about planning and how to provide these houses in the right places. I don't want to sound like a moaning house builder, but every young person will tell you their lot is not great right now.
No, and I think you're absolutely right. And this is what the podcast is about. It's about to actually get across to the public that we're not moaning. We're just stating some obvious facts.
But I think we could... What a wish for me would be that the wider public has a better understanding and a better perception of what we're doing as a housebuilding industry. And, you know, a lot of the stuff that we put out there as an industry is technical, isn't it, really?
Very much so.
It'll be housing numbers, planning and so forth. And a lot of, you know, the lay public are not involved in our industry. Frankly, it doesn't mean a lot to them. And I think that the... You know, we're doing some really good stuff. I think the quality of new housing being produced has got better and better and better. And we should do more for ourselves. We should get that word out there. I think that if the public thought new housing was a good thing, politicians would vote for it, wouldn't they?
Well, nobody votes for house builders, and politicians are only worried about what's coming in their inbox to be voted for. So if it doesn't get spoken about, politicians are not going to carry
and I think, I mean, it's not an overnight thing, is it? I mean, I think we'd need to spend certainly many, many months or years building that up, but doing it in a very simple way. You know, we were talking earlier about, you know, back in the day, whenever it was, the 70s, the Milk Marketing Board, and it was just milk, wasn't it, about milk. Yeah. And I think we should do the same thing in the housing world, get that word out there, get perceptions to improve... Not just homes to look at, live in, but what they do for an economy, what they do for local communities. You know, they make shopping, schools, facilities sustainable. All those sort of key points. And I think we could spend a lot more time doing that to help ourselves.
We don't promote ourselves as an industry, do we? We're not united.
No. I think we're too inward-looking, aren't we? And we've become, you know, I said earlier, we've become too technical. And you assume that people understand it. And, you know, I'm sure it's all the same for us. When we talk to mates not involved in the industry, and people are amazed, aren't they, at some of the stuff
absolutely.
That goes on.
Yeah. But I think that's one of the things that we need to look at as ourselves. And again, another thing about the podcast is what it's about is to try and actually get the house building industry to promote itself in the right light, to actually say, look, Joe Public, don't look at us as someone that you think doesn't just builds on green fields. That's all it does, because that's not the case whatsoever. But we don't seem to have this situation in the business itself, in the industry itself, to unite us all.
Yeah, I mean, as Richard said, you know, in the early 70s, whenever it was, there was a thing called the New Homes Marketing Board, which was, I think, promoted by the HBF. I could be wrong. But it followed the sort of Milk Marketing Board, as it was in those days. And I think it really did put new housing on the map. And it's not just about attracting buyers to buy new houses. It's the awareness of the population generally. And it's particularly the awareness of politicians of the importance of how the new build marketplace to Britain's economy. Because they just don't seem right now to understand it. It's all about NIMBYism. Well, actually, in my backyard is absolutely fine, just not in yours. That's the biggest issue. And how often do we go to dinner parties your host says, you know, it's absolutely terrible. Somebody's put an application in for 50 or 100 units in our village and we must stop this at all costs. And 5 minutes later they say, do you know what, it's absolutely disgusting. Our local village shop shut down. And also my young son, Johnny, he's having to live in Diss in Norfolk. No disrespect to Diss. And you say, well, do you not wonder why that is? Aren't these two things related? No, you're just a greedy house builder. They just don't understand.
But
benefits to society as a whole.
And you're absolutely right, but we don't promote that, do we? We don't.
No.
We don't, as an industry, actually sit there and say, in my book, and when I'm talking to more and more developers, some I've worked with over the years and some I haven't, everyone agrees. Yet, as much as I want to moan about the government, I think I can moan about our own industry.
Yes.
Because nobody is sitting there and saying... Yeah, we have to actually start marketing ourselves better. But I don't know. I don't know how we start that.
Well, I think the Home Builders Federation do a great job, and generally it's pulled most of the industry together. I think that would be the
place to start. Yeah.
Focus for it, I would think.
Well, we need to try and get something going. Talking about relationships, I've spent a little time with you guys in the past. You actually like each other, don't you?
Sometimes. No, we've got a really wonderful relationship, and it's funny, people assume that there's a lot of sibling rivalry, and because most siblings get on, but not that well, do they? And
I've seen lots of tear ups, and
so lucky that for our whole lives we've just got on very well. We have different strengths and weaknesses, so we dovetail quite well. And I think when we were our mother died when we were very young, I was 10, Graham was 12, and I think that really brought us together. And so, you know, obviously we're very close to our father. He was on his own for a while before he met our stepmother. But, you know, that really brought us together, and I think it's created that relationship we've got. And it's very special, and we treasure it. And we've never... I mean, one of the keys, I think, in our business careers is we've never said to the other one, well, I told you so.
Which is a lovely thing, a lovely trait not to bring into play.
And we would, you know, if it's my area or Graham's area, ultimately it's obvious to us as to who will make the final call, because we don't agree on everything. And then if, for example, Graham made a decision and I wasn't, you know, I didn't really want to go in that direction, I would never later, if it didn't go quite right, I would never say, well, I told you so, you've got, you know, and there's no blame culture.
And whoever's got to make the decision, as long as the other one is heard in full, because then you've got to make your mind up as to what the right decision is. I mean, on big issues, we never disagree. I mean, if you think we were at primary school, prep school, senior school together, same university.
Then you lived together for a while,
did you? Same university. Yeah, that was interesting. Same university, same hall of residence, same course. We lived together for 5 years.
5 years.
Before Richard got married. And then we worked together for 40 plus years.
During the time we lived together, I must tell you, I had one girlfriend the whole time. Graham had about 200. So it was quite a colourful time, yeah.
I think the only thing is we've never fancied the same girl. So that probably really helped.
In your case, that was a really important thing.
That was quite useful, yeah.
So you get along well.
Yeah.
Did your father, or did you feel responsible that you had to come into the business? Because he was a formidable man, was he? He was extremely well-respected. He was an amazing operator, very, very visionary. I don't use that word very often for people, but he would certainly be worth me mentioning that.
Well, as you know, he founded the firm of Bairstow East before we then founded Countryside. Right. So he was on the scene for a very long time. And the one thing he never, ever did for either of us was push us into this sector, industry, or business.
Did you feel that there was you mentioned losing your mum. Both my parents I've lost now. I wouldn't even know where to start losing either of my parents at a young age. Mm. Was there not a responsibility in the back of your mind that Dad was really good at property and you bonded and you'd got together closer?
No, not really. I mean, he never puts us under pressure like that. I mean, a lot of the time, nearly every weekend, we ended up making a trip out to look at some sites. I mean, he would normally take us out for lunch as well or something. So, we fancied that. But and I suppose it would just seem very natural. And he was a inspirational guy. And
but he was very good, Richard, wasn't he? As you say, subconsciously, he might have been preparing us for something. But he was really good at pushing us to make sure we thought of the wider job opportunities that were available in different sectors. He was really good at that, never really pushing us down this path. But when I being the older one, although that's always a bit of a joke between us who looks the older, but
well, you've had a tough time with all those women, mate.
Yeah, exactly.
So when I just, you know, when it's time to go to university, it was a natural thing for me to go off to university, and I read building construction, and 2 years later Richard went off and read land management. So we were sort of destined to go down that route of our own volition. And then when we both graduated, we went, you know, father was very much about pushing us out, go and explore the industry, take on different challenges, and if you want to come and work with me at Countryside, that would be great. But, you know, he was very, very good. But actually, come the day, it was the right thing to do, was to work together. And I think the story was, I'd accepted a job elsewhere after I left university, and I had a call from his then chairman, a chap called Bob Bobroff, who was in the industry as well. And he said, "Come, Graham, come, we'd fancy a bit of lunch at the cafe around the corner." He had a little office in Davis Street, central London. And I turned up at his office, and he took me to the cafe around the corner. That was called Claridge's. I sat there, and he said to me, "Graham, what on earth are you thinking going to work for somebody else? Your father is a sort of preeminent player in the industry with so much to learn. Why don't you work with him and drain him of every ounce of knowledge he's got?" And I sat there and thinking, do you know what, that makes a lot of sense. Isn't it? And I think he had the same conversation with Richard about 2 years later.
Yeah, and we were, I mean, it's amazing really, but a really young age, I mean, our very early 20s, we were given great opportunities to, you know, I remember the first day I started, I was given three sites to run as a development manager. I didn't have got a clue what I was doing, you know, made lots of mistakes, but you learn very quickly. I don't think we do that today. I mean, we're great believers in employing young people and training them up. I think that's fantastic. But you don't want to drop people in there too early on.
No.
But you do learn from your mistakes, don't you?
I mean, it's quite interesting. I had a good friend and someone I've worked with in the past on a while back who was a main board director at Barclay, and he worked very closely with Tony, particularly, bless him. And he said that in the podcast, he actually said, "I constantly hear Tony talking to me." Do you get when Dad stepped down from Countryside, did you have that situation then where you thought, and maybe you still have it today, where you think, what would the old man do?
Mm. I mean, he didn't step down, he died on the job, as it were.
Did he?
He developed cancer, and 6 months whilst he was still working, and he tried to keep working as long as he could, and he died within 6 months of the initial diagnosis.
I didn't know that.
So it was very quick. So I would say he died on the job as good as. He never stepped down or retired.
And was that, I mean, obviously it is a big hole when you lose. Was it even sort of worse in some ways because you work so closely?
Yeah, I mean, we saw him nearly every day for whatever it was, 30 years. So suddenly you haven't got that. And I think, you know, we're very lucky we've got each other, but I think, you know, talking a problem through, just sitting down, having a cup of coffee together, those simple things. So, yeah, it was a big hole.
And a lot of our approaches to life and work are very much born out of his coaching or
it's an interesting thing you say. There's a couple of things that you mentioned to me where I'm a very anti work from home person.
Yeah.
I left school with no qualifications at all. I was mentored, got lucky, met some people that actually I played sport with that were willing to give me a chance at the bottom level. A, they wouldn't have seen me if I was working from home.
Mm.
And B, my education of having a cup of coffee, sorting a problem out, just sitting there watching. You know, one guy used to say to me, right, on Tuesday mornings, come and sit in my office, sit the other side of the table and just be quiet.
And listen.
Just used to watch him on the telephone, calling people, trying to do deals, And I picked up mannerisms, and I picked up, you know, I could tell there was a bad phone call. It often, when it got crucial, we'd wander around, which is a trait I've got when I'm on the phone now in an important call. I'll wander around the office. I used to get this call tangled around his legs. Things would come. How do we get that across to the younger generation, the inexperienced people?
Yeah, I mean, we've found actually that our young people want to be in the office. And during COVID, during certain times of COVID, we had to keep them out, actually. And I think, you know, for a young person living on their own or, you know, sharing a flat with somebody, they've got to be in a team environment, haven't they, to learn? So we've got a 4-in-1 policy, four days in the office every week, one day you can be at home. And I think most of the young people want to be in the office all the time.
But the only
to get
trouble
that
is,
teamwork.
The only thing I would question then that they do... But only 3-4 days a week.
Well, I don't know. I think.
Oh, you see that? Listen, that's music to my ears.
Yeah, well, I think it's very encouraging. It's not. I mean, it's more. You know, there. It depends what people do, but if they're office bound, so it might be an accountant or say a lawyer or someone. I think you could. They do tend to want to have a day at home, but I think the young guys who work in our land team. Obviously, the construction guys, they can't be at home, can they? I mean, they've got to be on the sides. Well,
they're going to be a really good bricklayer if they can lay bricks.
Not going to go well, is it?
20 miles
yeah,
away.
Yeah. But so I think we were lucky there. And maybe it's... we've always put a lot of work into people, our team. You know, we spend a lot of time walking around the office, walking around the company, creating teamwork and wanting people to feel part of an organisation full of people and personalities. And I think that's helped a lot to create an enthusiasm for being there.
But I mean, and our particular work does mean poring over plans and drawings, contracts and financial appraisals. And it's difficult to do that in other than round a table. So working for them doesn't really suit that. And I think, you know, we've got a lot of young people work for us, and I think they crave and really appreciate the benefit of working in the office.
I mean, I get in trouble with some of my clients and some potential new business because unless there's a real genuine reason, and I did one this morning, goes against the grain for me, but a Zoom call, if there's a genuine reason, if somebody's the other end of the country or it's... But to actually run a business from Zoom, I don't get it.
No, I agree.
And there's nobody that's going to... can convince me at the moment, and I hear this constant, oh, will we log on?
Have you ever tried to interview someone on Zoom or Teams?
In the past, and I can't do
it. It's very difficult because even though you're seeing them, you can't quite see the body language.
The mannerisms, yeah.
Exactly.
Body language.
Exactly.
And it's the same with working with people, isn't it? You know, I struggle with, you know, well documented that I struggle with my emotional wellness. I can see people sometimes in the office that I think, do you know what? What's wrong with them today? Mm, they seem a little bit down you know, and you go back to that cup of coffee, you know, and walking around. I mean, there are times I walk around the office, I don't really need to know what they're doing. I'm walking around the office to see how they are.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Because the power of making somebody feel valued is... so underrated.
You imagine if you're a young person who does work from home and you think, I've got my whole career ahead of me, 40, 50 years ahead of work, and I'm going to be working in my kitchen or in my home office for decades. I mean, it's quite an unfortunate thought, isn't it?
I mean, it's... my times of working were getting on the train, driving up to London, whatever it was, and going out for a beer after or, you know, playing... We used to play rounders in the summer, believe it or kick the ball. Just, that's all part of human development. Hmm. That's the way that you grow. And I think we lose that, we've lost that. And then it just moves me on to, do we as an industry, I'm being told by some people that teachers say, house building's considered a dirty job now. Should we be getting back into schools to say, do you know, being a house builder isn't actually just being a bricklayer, a plasterer. There are many, many things involved in the house building and the construction industry.
Absolutely. There's a massive variety of jobs and skills and all sorts required to do what we do. If you think about the whole process from finding a site to handing over the last plot, defect free, there were so many tasks for so many different types of people. There's bags of opportunity for everybody, and that excludes all the people on site working. I mean,
absolutely,
young people are sort of rather poo-poo working on site. You know, they need to look at how much money you can actually earn as a bricklayer or sparky. You know, it would surprise them.
Probably some of our very best people have been people who've come in to join us at a very young age, who were sort of trained up. And it is fantastic then to see those guys, you know, whether they're on site or in a land role or whatever, to see a guy who's joined at the age of 20, 21, and he's then ended up as a managing director of one of the regions. Yeah. I mean, it's fantastic to see that happen. And
it started from an apprenticeship, effectively, didn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah.
Whether
exactly.
they went to university,
yeah.
they started there as a small girl or small boy, effectively. And there's so many people that I come across in industry that worked at Countryside.
Yeah, well, we had a fantastic graduate training scheme we had for 30 years. I think we were the first, actually, and we built that up. And at the peak times, we were taking 10 to 15 people in a year with a structured training program. They'd go do a rotation around all of the development disciplines and do extracurricular training. And even now, when we at Stonebond managed to secure one or two from the graduate training scheme, they're tip-top quality people, not over boasting about our own achievements, but they are very, very well trained and excellent people.
And people can earn a good living in a nice environment.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the problems, of course, is, you know, we talk about government policy and the fact that housing numbers this year are going to be, like, halved, probably. And I think that with that volatility of output and... That is the difficulty that has been with our industry, isn't it? That particularly on the construction side, somebody might be working 1 year and there's not a lot for them in the next year when times get tough.
Yep.
And I think, the huge power and the benefit that our industry gives the economy, if it was more consistent year in, year out, I think it would attract more young people, wouldn't it?
Well, we as a nation now, we don't build or make anything in the main. I think if you put the construction industry, I mentioned this earlier, if you put the construction industry together with the house building industry, it's the biggest generator of revenue for whatever chancellor, be that a chancellor on the left of the table or right of the table, let alone what Help to Buy did for the economy and the government. But it just seems that we don't understand that as government bodies, as authorities, and even people.
Labour are making some good signals, aren't they?
Some big noises coming out.
I suspect it'll be tougher to deliver what they're saying in practice. It'll take longer. But I think the fact that there's an intent there, real intent, and they seem to appreciate the power of it to the wider economy and building us out of the difficult place we're in at the moment. So I think all of that it bodes well, doesn't it? I mean, almost certainly they'll be elected and, you know, and in my view, thank God for that.
Do you know, Steve, how many housing ministers there have been in the last 40 years?
I mean, it's laughable. I mean, the present guy, he did do an apprenticeship, didn't he? Yeah, the COVID. I mean,
the average tenure is less than a year. How can a minister be in charge of such an important area?
I mean,
and be moved on after just when he's got his feet under the table. It's crazy.
It is mindless.
The trouble, not careful, we sound like three grumpy old blokes.
Well, listen, it's there's nothing wrong with being grumpy as long as my missus says don't come home grumpy, so I'll be grumpy with you guys. But talking about revenues and talking about money, the other thing that the industry does, I know this for a fact, it pours so much money into charities. Mm. You know, is there a charity that you as a business, you guys, is close to your heart?
So we when we came out, when we sold out of Countryside, we decided to set up a family charity, a family foundation. It's called the Cherry Family Foundation, and it supports youth charities. So twice a year, we've got a website and we have two rounds of funding every year. We get applications in. We started 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And initially we weren't known. We didn't know what we were doing. They didn't know how to set up a charity, but we managed to find our way through it.
Right.
And a bit of family involvement. So my daughter, in a bit of part-time, is the general manager. Graham's daughter is one of the trustees. So initially we just had a dozen applications. I think this year, on our last recent funding round, we had over 250 applications.
Really?
So, and we've made donations to date of 700,000. And the youth charities...
And that's in a couple of years?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
But the charities we've supported, so we've endowed it and we're giving the income to charities. But, so, I mean, they are heart-wrenching, some of those charities. So a recent one we supported was... a charity that puts mentors together with asylum seekers.
Hope for the Young.
Right.
And when you hear about some of the stories of people getting to this country, I mean, whatever your politics there, you can't help but...
Human suffering's not acceptable.
Yeah, exactly.
End of story.
But then to see these guys being linked up with a mentor who steers them down a path... and particularly the success story is when somebody has just qualified as a lawyer, doctor, whatever it is, or got a good construction job. It's fantastic to see that going on. We've given money to for youth offenders, for example.
Is this locally based stuff?
It's basically, we focus on small charities helping underprivileged people in deprived areas where we've lived and worked. So it's mainly London and the South East. Right. And it's charities where their annual turnover is modest, where a grant of 20 to 40,000 would make a material difference. So with respect, somebody like the NSPCC, we would never help because we're probably funding their paperclip budget. It's so big.
Yep.
And it's a very needy and worthwhile cause, but that's not where we focus on. But as Richard says, you know, the applications, they always include a video. I never watch them because I'd be in tears and want to give all the money to each one you watch.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I've done that on many charity events. I've come back and I've turned up and my missus, what have you bought now?
Is that going
to go? No, I didn't buy it because of that. It was an Arsenal show. No, I didn't buy it because of that. I bought it because, but there was a terrible story behind it. And it is upsetting.
Yeah.
Yet the industry, our industry, that we should be proud of, gives so much money to charity. But we need to be in an economy that's stable, and we need to be in an economy that's got some understanding of what we're trying to achieve.
Mm. At Stonewall itself, the staff nominate the charity for the year that we want to support, and then they do charitable either fundraising collection or even in putting time in to help the charities as well. So that's a corporate thing that we do as well.
Well, guys, I just want to thank you for coming on. I know you're really busy. We all know it's tough out there for us in the industry at the moment. I'm so glad that you guys are still around. I think it was a really ambitious plan what you had to go and grow Stonebond. And if I can help you guys in any way, then please let me know. But for me, it gives me a lot of comfort having people like you around with the experience you've got, the knowledge you've got, and the understanding. And that helps greatly. There'll be a lot of young people looking at this, and we might be grumpy old gits at times, but, you know, we got a lot of good stuff we can offer. Thank you for your time. I've really enjoyed your company. I look forward to having some breakfast or some lunch with you in the future. We come to the end of another Blighty Talks Bricks. I could sit here and talk to these guys all day long and have a few moans as well. But I hope you've enjoyed the episode. Look forward to seeing you soon. Take care and stay safe. Many thanks.